Bark at the Moon is another expedition into the world of shock horror. Bit of a different angle this time, though, Ozzy.
I think I've gone the full works this time. You can't get more horrific than the werewolf that I just done. In actual fact, it was a great experience doing that because I used a guy called Greg Cannon, who did a lot of work with the American Werewolf in London and a lot of horror things. I think he just did part of that Michael Jackson thing, the thriller as well. And it's very good. It is as uncomfortable as it looks, you know, to have all that. Cause it's all real human hair individually stuck on.
Where did you get the idea for that one?
Well, I thought of the idea from the album on the last American tour. But last year, I think I announced to the press last year that I was going to call it Bark at the Moon. And I got thinking, and I thought, well, if I do something. It's got to go the whole way. It speaks for itself, the title Bark at the Moon. It's got to be the horror werewolf thing, isn't it? So I just, my wife suggested doing some investigations and finding a real professional makeup artist, and she came up with Greg Cannon. It was great to work with as well. Very nice man.
Where does the whole idea of the madman, the werewolf, fit into the music that you do? What's the idea behind it?
Well, I don't know. It's a kind of a fetish that I have about. It's my sort of fantasy. I like to shock people, and the best I think with rock and roll, the best way to get people's attention is to shock them, but not in a horrible way. It's not for real. I'm not in reality. I'm not one of these freaks that gets off of seeing people as in London last week get blown up and all this. I'm not into all that for realness. It's like a fantasy that I like, there's no doubt about it. If you see this album cover in the racks, you go, what on earth is this album all about, you know? And it gets people's attention. Plus the fact that over the years since leaving Black Sabbath, I've developed somewhat of a reputation of being a... And it just all fits into place. It's what people expect of me, and it's what I like to do. And in actual fact, listening to the album, there's some very varied kind of music, and I'm sure that if they play this, I'd like to run a test one day of playing So Tired and saying, who is this man singing this song? It's a lovely song, I'm really proud of the song.
Writers like Edgar Allan Poe, Henry James, the people that wrote a lot of the books, the turn of the century horror books or mystery suspense books, were afraid in their own way, their own personal way, of the macabre, of something unfortunate happening to them. I wonder if you ever feel like you're testing Providence yourself?
I think every day we live on this earth, we test Providence. I mean, the threat of the nuclear war is far greater than Ozzy Osbourne. That is for real. Ozzy Osbourne is just a clown in a suit for the day, you know. We can take my suit off and put an ordinary clothes off and go out like anybody else. It is not. I don't try and test Providence, but I must admit, I have been attracting somewhat of the loonies in the world to me. I mean, people, no matter what you say, no matter how you try to justify what you do, there are always some people say, ah, but listen to what he's really saying. In between every word he's saying another meaning, and play it backwards and it'll mean, I sing for Satan and all that. Whatever you do, there'll always be somebody somewhere that'll read something into it. That's why, on the last album, studio album, Diary of a Madman, I was short of one title, and I thought to myself, I know what I'll do. I'll just get everybody's initial in this room, call it, like I said, my ex-wife was there, my new wife was there, and my ex-wife's a guy that she used to see years ago, and it was Sharon, Adrian, and somebody else, you know, and it worked out like that. It just worked out that way. And people come up to me and say, hey man, what does it mean? You know, it's like I've given them a new, but it's something for them to get an interest in. It's like, I always try and put something on an album sleeve or something that people take a little bit of time working it out, you know. I mean, on that live album, they put this old English writing, and I didn't have a clue what it said. I didn't even know. It was a record company who did that, but apparently it said something like, God bless you, Randy Rhoads, and I'll never forget you or something. But we had contests, and it's like a bit of an interest that goes with it, you know.
You mentioned Diary of the Madman, which is the last studio album you did. Now, with that studio album, there was a pretty impressive live show. You had a lot of props, different characters coming onto the stage. What's the difference? How is the new show for
It's a big production. I've seen mock-ups of it, and it looks very, very impressive. It's like, it's just kind of, what I can gather, the setting of the Psycho House, you know? And it's like a 3D effect. So this is what I've been told, I haven't seen it up yet. And it starts where the stairs are outside the front of the house, and as the show progresses, this backdrop goes away, and the stairs are the stairs actually in the house. And there's bats who sit on the end of the stairs and flap their wings, and lights go on, and there's a riser that does all these tricks with this riser, drum riser that comes down the stairs on hydraulics. The skeletons running out of cupboards and things. This is going to be like a pantomime of mayhem, you know.
What about your character? Now, you used Greg Canham's face makeup on the album. Are you going to develop that on the stage?
The thing is, the cost of material, the cost of stuff now, is outrageous, you know. It's like, I mean, I just had a quote for a suit. I was going to buy an actual werewolf suit of the same kind of thing, but it's like a body stuck and you just fit on yourself. $25,000, I mean, that's over. That's ridiculous, you know. I mean, I must be crazy if I even start talking to people about that. But that's the trouble with rock and roll today. It's becoming a very expensive business. And whatever you put out, so you have to charge the people then that much more to get in. And I think if something doesn't slow down, it's going to become like the dinosaur and go extinct, you know. You're not going to be able to see a big production. Because if somebody's got a new idea, it's not too long before the other side that people never see cash in on it, you know.
Lots of your image is theatre. It's there to make people sit up and listen, as is your music. To follow that through, you've had a lot of publicity, bats, biting bats and chickens and all the rest of it. Some of it's true and some of it isn't. And it's been productive for you. I wonder if there's ever been a time when you've wanted people to believe you, but because of your past reputation, they just won't.
It's like the thing to get to sound, the way you get on in rock and roll is make yourself known. And whatever anybody can say or whatever anybody wants to say or whatever anybody wants to think about Ozzy Osbourne, I certainly achieved that. A lot of people know who I was, who didn't know what I was, who I was before. But I think I wish now these people would not just recognise me for being the bat-biting maniac. Have a listen to some of the music, you know, just give it a shot, because I'm sure the people will be somewhat surprised at some of the things I do.
What about the chat show host now? I know you've been on some of the American chat shows and people have kind of kept a slight distance from you because they've seen your publicity shots and so on.
What was that show I did in New York? I forgot the name of the show.
Donahue, was it?
No, he's on before. Or, no, it's on after Carson, this guy. Whatever. I did it, and this guy, after the show, he said, do you know, he said, I'd built a picture in my mind what was going to walk through that door. And he said, I was absolutely floored after speaking to you. Because I was like, because these guys are there to rip you to shreds. And this guy thought I was going to freak out, throw blood everywhere and start being gross. And he says, you know, you have got a brain, you know. And it's like, what I can't understand, and I never will understand, that people in this day and age still believe in what they read. I mean, you know, they are selling newspapers, and we spoke this morning about if they haven't got a sensational story, they ain't going to sell a newspaper. And I was wondering the other day, I thought to myself, can you imagine, there's got to be a day in the year that there's absolutely not that much news to write about. And can you imagine putting a newspaper on a stand saying, today's Times, no news, and just blank pages? They'd have to create something, or, you know, because they're out to sell newspapers. It's like I'm out to sell records. Like you're out to do a good radio show and sell your radio show. It's all a part of job, you know.
You're out to do a good album and make it sell, because that's your profession and your livelihood. Now, have you ever thought of doing it from a different point of view? You used the occult, you've used sort of satanic ideas, madmen, werewolves. You've used all that element, occult element, if you like, in your music. I wonder if you've ever thought of changing direction completely, radically.
I don't know, because, I don't sort of say, oh yeah, the next album's going to be gross, it's going to be the sickest thing in the world. I do, in actual fact, the album covers sometimes aren't very complimentary of the music that's inside, you know, and that's really what I'm all about, is what goes in the sleeve, you know. But I do like a bit of I like freaking out with all these clothes and makeup and bangs and hairs and wigs and blood capsules and it's like I like Halloween night, you know. It's like I first got the idea actually in Denver, Colorado, many years ago when I did a show for Barry Fay in the Coliseum, and it was a Halloween night where everybody dressed up and had a competition for the freakiest guy to win. And all these different guys were wearing these. The one guy that won was amazing. He had this suit made with his head under his arm, and it was great. And it's like a bit of fun, you know. It's like, what's happened to all that? I mean, people should not take it as seriously as they do. It's just a bit of fun. It's just, hey, let's go crazy for a night, you know.
Let's talk about the album now, the new album, Bark at the Moon. Now, it's an album that you wrote most of the songs for, although you co-wrote some of them with Bob Daisley, your bass player. And the album was produced by yourselves and Max Norman, with a bit of engineering help from Max as well.
I get ideas, you know. It's like I get a vocal line or a melody and an idea for a song, and I have to sort of rely on sort of musical help of someone else. Although I've got the tune and it's all worked out, I can't play an instrument, so therefore I have to sort of work on an idea with someone else, you know.
Do you have any more papers?
No.
How do you get those ideas?
Well, I mean, for instance,
some hash.
I mean, for instance, Rock and Roll Rebel, I was sitting on a plane going to New York early part of this year. I'm reading this magazine, and it's about the time when it got really heavy with these religious movements and all this. And I read this article, and it was like every other paragraph was a ministry of this, and the ministry of defense, the ministry of war, the ministry of peace, the ministry of death. And I thought to myself, what right do these people have to put me down for playing rock and roll music? And you got all these different jerks who are the ministry of this and that, who, because they are called a ministry of death, they can send a million people to their death. And I just wrote the words, the ministry of peace, I just don't understand, you know. It just lives in a cloud. And it's like, I can't understand what I'm trying to do. It's for me, it's for me, it's for you, it's for you. I'm just a rock and roll rebel. And it's just like, that's true, that's all I am, is a rock and roll rebel. I will never conform to their way of thinking because I don't believe in it. I've never had any of my children blessed by in religious. Although I don't say I'm not religious, but I feel that what right do I have to say to my little child, you should be this religion? Because I think a religion is a very strong thing, and I think no parent has the right. This is not what everyone should think. I'm not preaching, by the way. I think that when a child's of an age to think for itself, and if it wants to be a Catholic, Protestant, Jew, or whatever, it has the right to think for itself and say, yeah, that's what I fancy getting. And I've never hidden anything about religion away from my children. It's just the way I think. I think not normal as far as the rest of the world thinks on all these matters. And I just, the way I write, it's like I get to a situation in my head and I think, I've created this monster that people believe. And yet, if I was the Ministry of Monsters, it'd be okay. You know, if I was the Ministry of Monster Creation, it would be cool. Everybody.
I mean, if you had an official title, you think people would accept it because of your official title and not because of what you were saying, necessarily?
I mean, just look what happens, just look what is happening. How many people are getting killed for nothing? As far as I'm concerned, it's just pointless deaths.
Well, let's move away from that song. Talk about how you write songs. Now, some of the songs that you wrote on the album, you did with Bob. How do you actually sit down and put a song together?
I get all the vocal tunes and the songs, and then that is basically a song. The 75% of any song is the melody. And I get the melodies and I get all this and I start writing the words. I have a few bits of... people throw a few things in and make it a bit more interesting. And that's the way I do it, you know. It's not very difficult.
And is that something that happens in the studio during the recording, or do you do that over the months?
I mean, I write ideas as I go along. I've got another idea for a song at the moment called Don't Rock the Doomsday Clock, you know.
It sounds a bit of a rock and roll of that.
Yeah, it's just sort of I'm very, very worried about world peace at this present time, because I think it's a very important thing that we should really start doing something about, because once it's happened, all that junk starts flying around, it's all over, you know. And I think it's not a thing to just say, oh, what's he on about now, you know.
lineup for the band's remained pretty much the same since the last album, Diary of a Madman, with the exception of the live lineup, and that is Carmen Appice's replaced Tommy Aldridge. Firstly, why did Tommy leave the band? And then secondly, if you can, talk about the rest of the group.
Well, when I'd never recorded a studio album with Tommy Aldridge. Tommy Aldridge is a very loner man. He's not like a band member. He's very quiet when he's off stage. He's got his own little world that he goes around in. And it's sort of like, you begin to feel, well, what am I doing? What am I sitting here for? With a guy that might say four words. When he feels happy, he wants to talk. And when he don't feel happy, he just goes and sits and don't say anything. And I never recorded a studio album with Tommy. And I suddenly thought, I wonder if it's going to be what I want in the studio. Though Tommy's great on stage. It's stage people and the studio people. And it's a very difficult thing for a lot of people. And Tommy hadn't recorded an album for many years. And I suppose it didn't work out as far as I was concerned. I wasn't too happy with what was going down with the percussion side of it. You know, it's a lot of problems we had, which I don't want to bore you with the technicality of it, but we had a few problems and I just decided I've got to find a drummer that has got a lot of guts and a lot of heaviness with him, you know, because the rocks numbers need a solid drum, you know, to keep it down. Because if you don't keep a solid rhythm, it flies off the, you know, it speeds up, speeds up, speeds up until it ends up like a punk version of Paranoid every night, you know.
In 1983 going into 84, do you think you've arrived at the right combination of musicians? Because your career as a solo artist since Black Sabbath, you have been through a number of different musicians, haven't you?
Well, the thing is that I was with Black Sabbath for like 11 years of my life, after a while you kind of get bored with playing with the same guy. The challenge goes, you lose your hunger. It's like it happens all the time. A hungry band is the best band you can get because they're fighting every day to get good, you know. And I think when I feel that complacency sets into the band, that's when I make changes, because it gets like, oh, you're doing it. It's like the fun goes, you know. It's just like we all know the parts. And yes, I have had a lot of musicians, but it isn't a band. It's not the Ozzy Osbourne band. It's Ozzy Osbourne and whoever he's playing with on the night, whoever he runs to record with. I just keep making music. It doesn't really matter to me who plays with me, as long as it's that good enough.
Do you find that a healthy arrangement for yourself?
Yeah, it's. I don't really want to get attached to anybody, because then you start getting a personal involvement, you know. It's like, and the saddest thing that can ever happen is when you lose somebody that you feel. Like when I lost Randy Rhoads in that crash, it was an awful feeling. And so I don't really like to get myself that attached to any member of my party that work with me now.
It kind of shook you up so much that you really don't want to get tied in with anyone now.
Not really, because it's like when you go through a situation like a tragedy, like when Randy got killed, you can never really answer your own head. You mean it's like you're saying to yourself, why did this happen? What did I do so bad for some ill-fated thing like that to happen? And it's just a thing that you live with every day of the week. Even now, I mean, it goes through my head, why did he get on that plane? Why did it all happen, you know? It never really happened. It's like a bad dream, you know?
Well, that's how you feel about the members in your group, that you want a commitment, obviously, but you don't want them to be too attached because you may move on to something else. What kind of demands do you put on them? What do you expect them from them?
I expect to keep playing as well as they. I mean, everybody has a bad night. I mean, I'm not like a sergeant major. Like, you will be there at 9 a.m, put boots polished and salute, sir. It's a pretty fluctuated sort of situation. But it's just like I like to have fun. I don't like to be that serious about we are going and we're going to go out there. I mean, I've seen bands over the past that. I mean, to play music, you've got to be love life. You've got to be enjoying yourself. And I can't see where you can get chemistry and mix it with rock and roll and hope to come out with anything but a chemical rock and roll band, you know? Like the early sort of like Yes, ELP kind of thing. It's like, see, I've got to take like a pill to listen to the record to find out what key and different tempo changes are going. That's okay for some, but for me, I don't really like that. But I've heard some of the new Yes album, and I've definitely made a change for more to me kind of music. I think it's very good now.
When you embarked on your first tour of the States following your departure from Black Sabbath, you went straight into the arenas, I guess that was a risk that paid off.
No, I didn't. The first tour I did of America, I did small theatres, headline small theatres, and from word of mouth. I mean, we did a big tour of America of small, like 3,000 or 4,000 seaters, and it was surprisingly nice to find out that as you're going around, it's picking up, and that's the part of rock and roll that I really like when you're building something and it's working. That's a great feeling. Once you've got there, you just carry on then, you know. It's like, I like that sense of achieving something as I'm going along.
That's it. And then the second one, you went out and did the 20,000 seaters. Yeah, yeah. Now, one of the things you did during that tour, I believe, was you did the Nassau Coliseum, Meadowlands Arena and Madison Square Garden, three major venues in the New York City area, all within about 10 miles of downtown Manhattan.
That was great. I mean, I think that was the first time anybody had ever done that. I think we played into like 80,000 people in 4 days in one area, which is phenomenal. I mean, this time we're going to do the same again, and we're going to do 2 days at the Philadelphia Spectrum. It's great. It's just like, I mean, when I left Sabbath, in actual fact, when I say I left, it was like fired, but I'm leaving kind of thing. It was like, you're leaving tomorrow. No, I'm not. Yes, you are kind of thing. And I was very angry, and I'm one of these guys, when I get very angry, I'll pull all the stops out until I get my own back. It was like a vendetta that I had to pay back, which I've got over now. I've got over that all that thing. I mean, I don't...
You mentioned Sabbath. Now, the last studio album before Bach was the Diary album, but there was also a live album that came out almost the same time as Black Sabbath's
that wasn't
live.
It was planned to come out as Black Sabbath, the same time as Black Sabbath. In actual fact, if it was, their manager must be crazy, because their manager now was my manager at the time, and if he had had any, he must have known the inclinations. Why would he put the two things out at the same... Well, he didn't have any control over that, but... The reason why I did that album, I was contractually obligated to CBS Records to deliver a live album. The original live album was going to be one side of my stuff with Randy, and the other side of old Sabbath classics. Which I thought, oh, fair enough. I mean, I didn't have that much of my own material. But then after I'd committed myself, I suddenly thought to myself, what am I doing? I've done it now, I've signed the deal. And a week or so later, I thought, what am I doing putting an album, live album out of my stuff, which is still selling in the shops? The studio albums, it just doesn't make sense. But I recorded it anyway, and then Randy got killed, and I thought, well, I know exactly what's going to go down here. 8 months after his death, putting out a live album with Randy Rhoads on, the record company's going to stick a big sticker on featuring the late, great Randy Rhoads, and I said, forget it. You know, I just went in with Brad Gillis and Rudy Sarzo and Tommy Aldridge, and just did it all Sabbath stuff. It was just to fulfill that contractual obligation. I don't really recognise that as an album, you know. It was a situation that I couldn't get out of.
Now, the band that you just mentioned, the lineup there was almost all American, I think, with the exception of yourself. That's been something that you've done since Black Sabbath, that is to employ in the band combination of both American and British musicians.
The reason for that is I find my form, my kind of music, there's a lot more people in America playing that kind of guitar and that kind of bass, that kind of keyboard, that kind of drums. Because England, when I first left Sabbath, was in a very weird musical frame of mind, in the respect that they all had different coloured hairs and suits, ties, and didn't... I forgot about the instrument, you know. A lot of them couldn't play, and it was all keyboards and synthesizers and all this. I know I'll find somebody in America. I knew that I would find a guitar player of the caliber that I was looking for in America. Although I did miss out on a good shot once at John Sykes, which was one of the mistakes I made. And he's now joined Whitesnake, I believe. But I didn't. I mean, I was tired and burnt out after two, and I didn't really give him a fair shot at the audition. But you know, these things happen.
Looking at one particular musician or performer, that's Ian Gillan. Now, he's now taken over the reins of the lead vocal part in Black Sabbath. How do you feel about that?
Well, I tell you, I'm not an authority on what anybody should do, but as an outsider, I'm not just saying, there's a lot of kids that come to me and say, what are they doing? What are they trying to do? And a lot of them, kids, do you think it's just a financial exploitation what they're trying to, because it's like their version of a heavy metal supergroup? I think when you take a singer from any band who you've recognised. It's like if Mick Jagger left the Rolling Stones and joined the Who would then sound like Rolling Stones, or similar, because of Mick Jagger's voice. Because a singer is a part of that whole sound. Now, when Ronnie James Dio was with him, to me, it sounded like Rainbow. Now, it sounds like a weird version of Deep Purple or Ian Gillan Band, you know. It's just, I think what my personal opinion is, that what they should have done was get a totally unknown singer and try again with a new name, you know. Because it doesn't sound like Black Sabbath anymore. It never will do again.
Well, now, you've got the man in your band at the moment, and that is Carmen Appice, who's very well known in America for a lot of associations with different groups. At the sort of high end of jazz rock, if you like, a lot of mainstream R&B as well. He replaced Tommy for the tour and has now become an integral part of the band. How do you see his contribution? Because he takes a solo and he sort of gets the audience going in the middle.
That's what I like to see. I mean, everybody's seen the drum solo, and I said to Carmen when he joined, I said, what's your drum solo like? He said, well, see what you think. And it's great because he said to me many a night, if you want me to go technical, I'll blow their minds with something technical. But we're playing to kids that want to get banging their heads and stamp their feet and clap their hands, and that's what I'll give them. I mean, one thing about Carmine, what I've found is very unique, he knows what audience he's playing to. If he plays with a Rod Stewart band, Ozzy Osbourne band, or anybody, he knows what that audience are about. So therefore, he plays his drums accordingly. Instead of playing, I mean, people say, Tommy Aldridge, he's still playing the same drum solo as he played with Pat Travers, as he played with Black Oak Arkansas. Now, Black Oak Arkansas, Pat Travers and Ozzy Osbourne are three of the totally different audiences. We don't have anything remarkable, but he doesn't coordinate his drum solo accordingly with the audience, whereas Carmine does. I mean, he's a great guy, he's into the business, he knows what it's about, he's a very productive man, as long as he's doing my thing, but at the same time he's doing a lot of his own solo stuff, and, you know, all the luck in the world, the guy's productive, and you can't hold anybody back that's productive.
Jake E. Lee, another new face on guitar, coming up through the ranks now.
I think sooner or later he's going to be one of the biggest guitar players in the world one day. I honestly believe that, because he is phenomenal. He's a great guy, great player.
Looking at Jake, for example, do you see yourself a bit as a training ground for musicians? Because you have had a lot of very good people.
I like to think that, because, I mean, I get excitement out of seeing, like, different people that have come along to me, gone through the training course. Because everybody I get, especially with guitar players, have never done it before on this big circuit. So it's one hell of a sort of jerk in the backside to sort of go, 20,000 people. I mean, I've actually had people just freeze, you know, I can't handle it, you know, I can't do it. But if they can get through it, they learn a lot, you know, and I feel very accomplished in the fact that I've put back into the music some part to generate another band. Because that's what, I mean, it's like I feel like the old general of rock, you know, like, come to my camp and you'll learn. And it's true, a lot of people, I mean, when Jake first came to me, he was green, he was like frightened. And what I like about these young kids is, it's like a football player who admires a big star and he wants to be that guy, but he never gets a break. And it's great to see somebody leave this superstar standing and go further. It's a great feeling, I feel good about it, you know.
Oh, so let's look at America now. Now, it's a very important marketplace for you. I know you've been busy getting the new tour together in Europe and Britain, but now we're off to America in the new year, 1984. What's the size of this tour? How long is it going to be? And where are some of the venues?
It's only a short tour, 8 months. It's only a short tour. It's 8 months long. No, I'm gonna just do the 8 month tour, and then hopefully. Eventually I will have a break, but it's like I keep moaning and groaning, I want a break. But when I get a break, I just walk around thinking, what do I do now, you know? Just get the old pen out and just start messing around and doing something else. It's just like I have a kind of a love-love-hate-hate relationship. When I'm on the road, I want to be at home. When I'm at home, I want to be on the road. So there's not really that much satisfying me, is it?
With Europe, you've been trying out new songs from Bark at the Moon, and I noticed last night when we were watching the show here in Dortmund that the kids are mouthing the words, so they've obviously learned
it. I'm glad, because I forget most of them myself half the time. Well, you know, sometimes it's funny, I mean, you'd be surprised, but it's like even paranoid. I forget the words sometimes. Like, it's got a mental block. Like, what the hell am I doing, you know? I come home and the mic.
Talking of Paranoid and Iron Man, two songs that you frequently incorporate into the repertoire of a live set, do you still like playing Sabbath songs?
I love playing Paranoid, and I mean, I never will. It's like my anthem. I mean, that is a classic standard heavy rock. So I think that is one of the anthems of heavy metal, you know. That and Smoke on the Water. I mean, it's just like, it never seems to get aged. It's an ageless song, you know. Iron Man's just, it's there. It's like it's part of my heritage and history. I mean, when I announced it and said, now I'm going to do a track from my old band, Black Sabbath. And some nights I think, Jesus Christ, it's like 13 years old what I'm doing, you know.
Do you ever get afraid of digging up ghosts from the past because of the fact that it's a song that's very much to do with Black Sabbath as opposed to Ozzy Osbourne, the solo artist?
Not really, because, I mean, the early Sabbath stuff I was a part of as much as anybody else was. I mean, if anybody should worry about it, it's the people in Black Sabbath now who are singing them too, you know. So they don't even know what the vibe was about when we wrote them, you know.
When you left Black Sabbath and went out on the road, it was pretty, on your own, it was a pretty risky thing to do, but you survived it and you've gone on from there to success.
I survived it mainly and solely because, through my wife. My wife was a fabulous woman, a fabulous coach, hard-working mother. I mean, but she's that's what you've got to do, you know. You've got to be dedicated. When Sabbath used to treat it more of a sort of a paying hobby than an actual profession, in the respect that we never used to tour that greater tours, which is like maybe two or three 7-week tours a year in the end, which is not really touring. It's like a paying hobby. It's just like when we need some money to buy a new car, we'd go on the road, you know.
Heavy metal is your main ingredient in music, and yet you've added strings to the new album, Bark at the Moon. Lou Clark helping you out there. Are you getting soft, Ozzy?
Well, it's not that I'm getting soft. It's like, if you listen to every one of the Ozzy Osbourne records since I left Sabbath, there's a ballad on every album. And the first album was like Goodbye to Romance. And then there was You Can't Kill Rock and Roll. And, you know, it's just, I like to put a bit of variety on an album instead of just sticking to the one bang, 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 all the way through. I think it gets boring. I like doing a ballad now, and it's like I get pleasure out of hearing it, you know.
1984 is a week away now. What resolution have you got? New Year's resolution for 84 have you got?
Have fun, enjoy myself, and try and stay healthy. Because I mean, I've been real sick lately. I had this flu that's nearly knocked me on my back for about 3 weeks. I do try and stay as healthy as possible. But when these flu bugs come out of the Asic every year, they go, oh, where's Ozzy? We go and get him. He deserves a good dose of us.
The only side of Ozzy that a lot of people see is the man who's made up in his maniacal outfit, exactly as you're about to strangle me. And yet, behind that's a real soft guy. He's got a lovely little daughter now. You're madly in love with her, aren't you?
I love her. Can't wait to see her. She's coming on the road. First tour, she's got a little tour jacket. And she's grabbing. That's the part of it that people, it amazes me that people think that I'm never sleep, I'm a maniac all the time. Even maniacs have to sleep and just cool down a bit, you know, because it's what I've created, and I can't expect any difference, I don't suppose, really, because that's what I created, that's what I led people to believe, you know, that's what they think of me, so what do I got to learn to live with it and cope with it, that's all.
How long do you think you're going to be able to keep it up for?
I don't know, you know, it's like some days I feel, oh, my back's aching, my legs are aching, I was up too late drinking too much last night. But it's like, I don't know until somebody says to me, until they say your record's not selling anymore, I suppose that's when I'll stop, you know.
Any other ideas on what you'd like to do when that happens?
I really don't know, I keep saying to them, what are we going to do when it's all over, you know? Shut up, you know, just shut up and tell me about it some other time, not now.
Happy being Ozzy Osbourne and making music.
I love it, every minute of it. Hi, this is Ozzy Osbourne.